Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts every week from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
And we are back with another episode of Lending Forward. And I've got the one and only Barry Habib on with me today. If you have been living under a rock and you don't know who Barry is the CEO of MBS Highway. And he is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to mortgage and housing and economic expertise. So Barry, welcome to Lending Forward.
I'm thrilled to be here with you, Hannah.
Great. Well, we had you on our Engage speaker series a couple months ago, and we know that the market can change in an instant. So thank you for coming back on the podcast. But before we dive into all things economics and mortgage rates, I want to check on you. How are you doing?
Well, that's very kind of you. So went through a very rigorous chemo regimen and was blessed that I was able to go through it. It was very, very intense. It was 4.5 months. I look a little different, as you could see, but
you look phenomenal.
Thanks. Finally, you know, just funny you mentioned this weekend. Saturday was like the first day I started to feel good. You typically get like a week that you feel good because you're 3 weeks apart, the intervals of chemo, and then it's 5 days of constant infusion and chemo. And so just as you started to feel a little bit better, you got hit again. So this time, not going to get hit again. Praying to God for good results from the scans that we're going to do on September 3rd. And we're optimistic. And then, you know, it's in God's hands after that, because this does have a meaningful chance that it might come back. Mm-hmm. So I'm researching, trying to do everything I can, you know, maybe radiation, this and that, just in a preventative phase to do everything I can. Right. And meanwhile, I'm just going to live life and try and do good and be happy every day. Right. Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love the outlook. I, you know, all of us at Atlantic Bay are praying for you. So
thank you.
You know, we'll support you every step of the way.
But I love you guys. You guys are dear friends. And I don't even have words to tell you how much appreciation I have for you.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, let's dig into this crazy economy. I want to start with, let's start with inflation. We obviously know that's been a huge concern lately. How do you see inflation trends evolving over the next year or so?
So inflation has been coming down in the rate of change. It doesn't do anything for the inflation that we've seen. It's cumulative to that. So people feel it because the, you know, 18, 19% that we have, people live with that. And now it's what's adding to that is at a slower pace. Mm-hmm. And that slower pace is still above what the Fed wants. The Fed has made up this target of 2%. It is not a, it's not a rationale. It's nothing like that. It goes back to 1996. Janet Yellen, who was not a good Fed chair, not a good Treasury secretary, pressed Alan Greenspan to say, look, if you had to. And he finally, he didn't want to. But his words were, if I were forced to, I'd say 2%. But he said, I'd hate to think what would happen if that number got out of this room. Well, guess what? It did get out of the room. And Ben Bernanke started to talk about it. Janet Yellen really hammered it home. And now it's been adopted as you want a 2% target. Whatever. That 2% target is on core PCE, and we're above it. We're at 2.6%, not terribly above it, but above it still. Now, it is going to be stubborn in trying to come down, not because, and this is what people misunderstand, actually the monthly numbers are starting to fall in line, where you're starting to see monthly readings. But in 2023, the monthly readings were actually very low. So when you get a new monthly reading, although it's somewhat benign, it replaces a really low number from 2023. So it's hard to make progress on a year-over-year basis. Eventually we will. You can actually see inflation on a year-over-year basis going up. But focus on the monthly numbers, because I think that'll be true. And the key function here is shelter costs. Shelter makes up 45% of core CPI. It makes up 18% of core PCE. So it's a very big weighting. It's the second largest weighting in core PCE, the largest weighting in core CPI. Shelter, it's got the way the BLS computes it, it has a very terrible lag. They just don't do a good job. They look at an area from 6 months ago and then they forget it. And mm-hmm. when they capture that area from 6 months ago, it could have been a lease that was signed 8 months before that. So it's older looking data, it's showing that rents, which represent these big chunks, are going up at roughly 5.2% a year. Yet everywhere else, even the Fed itself, the Cleveland Fed, says 4%. Today, we got numbers from Zillow. And Zillow said that we're coming in under 4%, at 3.4%. CoreLogic said 3%. Redfin says closer to 3%. So all of these data points are saying the real number is, let's call it somewhere between 3 and 4. But yet, at 5.2%, when you do the math, that roughly 2% overstatement or 1.5% overstatement of inflation means what the Fed's looking at is numbers that are old numbers for what the inflation is. And we're probably a lot closer to that 2% target or at the 2% target if we took today's numbers into account.
Right.
So I think, to answer your question, inflation will get there, but the Fed is not going to necessarily just look at inflation, because the Fed has two mandates. The Fed has inflation, and then they have the mandate for what they call maximum employment. So they want the words are price stability, which they made up to be 2%, and maximum employment. What does that exactly mean? Hard to put your finger on it. But we have seen that unemployment rate jump much higher, as you know.
Yeah. And that was going to be my next question was, what do we kind of expect the Fed to do in the next couple of months? Especially, I mean, an election is coming up. We've heard about some rate drops. What are you kind of expecting them to do in the next, you know, couple months, rest of the year?
Well, the Fed's got to cut rates. They're behind the curve, meaning the economy is already tilted lower and the Fed's still here. So the curve is here. The Fed's behind it. They've got to catch up. Now, they're in what's called a very restrictive policy. So what does that mean? For roughly, for all intents and purposes, let's say the Fed funds rate, it's between 5.25 and 5.5. That's their target range. So it's 5.375. So let's call it 5.4. But yet, the rate of inflation by their own measurement, which is lagging, which we know it's lower because I just explained to you, that's 2.6. So that's an extreme amount above that. Now, you probably would want to be somewhere about 0.75% above this. So let's just use round numbers. Let's call it 5.4. They need to be somewhere around 3.4, around there.
Yeah.
They're roughly 2% above. So I could see about 200 basis points or a 2% over time decrease in the Fed funds rate. Now, that's assuming that inflation doesn't continue lower or the economy doesn't get worse, because then they're even further behind the curve. You see why it's behind the curve? Because they're constantly trying to catch up. Mm-hmm. They did the same mistake using the same shelter numbers that lag when they let inflation get out of control. Inflation was doing this and they waited. And then they started doing this and inflation kept chasing it.
Right.
And that's what they were behind the curve. Then they're behind the curve now. It's interesting because the Fed says, well, we know that Fed response has long and variable lags. They know it. They say it, yet they don't act that way. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, what do I think they will do? I think that is they're going to cut in September, on September 18th. I know you also mentioned elections. Correct. I know you also mentioned elections. The Fed has told us, and they really do try and say, look, we want to be taking action irrespective of what happens politically.
Right.
I think they really want to do that. So I think that the Fed's going to try and do whatever they need to do without what it would have a bearing or not on the election. Plus, if the Fed cuts rates in September, even if it's aggressively, you know, what do you have? You have 6-7 weeks or so before election. A Fed action of 0.25% or 0.5%, it's not going to change anything in the economy, you know, so it's not going to do anything. The one thing it might do is it may or may not, there's conflicting information, help the stock market. Okay. A lot of times when the Fed begins a rate cutting cycle, believe it or not, the stock market actually starts to do worse historically. Doesn't mean it'll happen. But sometimes the stock market could react favorably to Fed rate cuts. So, you know, a happier stock market could, in history, it is one of the points that goes towards the incumbency being happier, okay, or better. A very bad stock market is one of the many points that goes into consideration of the incumbency, you know, the voters not being as happy. So just one of many points to consider.
Okay.
But back to, what does the job numbers do? What does that mean for the Fed? What does it mean for the economy? I think that while it may not move up in a straight line, I think the unemployment rate will move higher. It's a surprise to many Fed members because, look, just back in June, when the Fed was asked, where do you think the unemployment rate will be? There's 19 Fed members that anonymously told us, 16 of the 19 Some of them said 3.8, some said 3.9, some said 4, some said 4.1. That's 16 Fed members. Only three Fed members thought it would be higher than 4.1. And here we sit at 4.3, right? So I have to think that a lot of these Fed members are starting to say, maybe the economy is worse than what we thought. We probably need to be careful not to induce a really nasty recession, because if that starts to happen, that unemployment number starts to get out of control. And then it feeds off itself. The reason why the unemployment rate is so important, because if you don't have a job, well then you're not going to spend. And if you don't spend, the economy gets worse and worse and worse. And as businesses get worse, they lay more people off. The unemployment rate goes up, less people spend. So it's a vicious cycle that can continue. So they don't want to let that genie out of the bottle. So I think they will start cutting. Now, when they do, what does that mean for us? Mortgage rates, house.
That was going to be where I was going. What does that mean for us?
So, you know, you and I are right on along the same path, right? So, you know, we're right along the same lines when we're thinking about transitioning to labor and now transitioning to what it means for us, mortgage rates and housing. I think that this means that there's a big opportunity. I do believe that as inflation comes down, as the economy continues to show some signs of slowing, and as the Fed gets more accommodative, I think that historically, and you know, things can change, right? But historically speaking, we should see mortgage rates decline. And they will decline for two specific reasons. One is that, you know, a big influence on mortgage rates, while they don't follow exactly the 10-year treasury. If you look at some historical levels, it would be reasonable to think that the 10-year treasury, currently in, you know, 3.95-ish as we record, could get down to 3.25. And even less, could it get down to 3 or 2.75? I don't rule that out at all, depending on how we see the unemployment rate go, how we see the job numbers go, how we see the economy slow, and inflation should be slowly but surely more cooperative. I don't rule that out. I think those are reasonable numbers. But even at 3.25, currently, if the 10-year treasury would drop to 3.25, that would probably push mortgage rates to teetering 6%, maybe below 6%. But there's another aspect, and that is called the spread. If you take the 10-year treasury and mortgage rates on a historical level, it's been about 1.75, 2% between the two. But as mortgage rates have escalated so much, part of the value of a mortgage is something called servicing value. And servicing value is highly dependent on how long that servicer holds the mortgage, holds the servicing value. I'm sorry, the mortgages are all sold, but holds the rights to the servicing, because the longer they hold the rights, the more fees they collect. Yeah. The lower interest rates are, the less people would refinance. But when rates get above 7, 7.5 or so, the chances of that refinancing are likely, because all you need is a little drop, and a drop is likely. People were probably going to be, and you're going to see a big boom in refinancing upcoming. Well, that means the servicing value is very small. So that's less value of the mortgage, which means that the spread between mortgage rates and treasuries had gone really high towards, instead of the historical 1.75 to 2, 3%. As rates have come down, that's shrunk to about 2.6, 2.7. But guess what? As the 10-year treasury drops, as mortgage rates get lower the mortgage rates, the less of the high probability of refinancing, the greater the servicing value, the tighter the spread gets to. So let's just use those made up numbers. Yep. Let's say we get 3.25. And let's say that servicing even modestly shrinks to 2.5, right? I'm sorry, the spread shrinks to 2.5. That puts mortgage rates at 5.75. So now let's transition to your other question, right? So we all want to know, what does this mean for housing? Is housing a good investment? I think it's such a great investment now because of a couple of things. Number one is that there is just not enough supply and too much demand still, just based upon demographics. But the other aspect is that according to the National Association of Realtors, you drop rates 1%, our scenario would be around a 1% drop in rates or so around there. Well, 5 million more people become eligible. Of course, not all of them are going to be buyers, but even a small portion of those 5 million become buyers in this tight inventory environment. It means tight inventory becomes tighter. It means there's less choices, but it also, most importantly, means prices will move higher. In that scenario, you want to take advantage of that and be a buyer now before you get that upward surge, as opposed to waiting and pay the piper. If you do the difference in the next year, I think prices will rise about 5%, you know, even on a $500,000 home. 5% rise in prices means if you waited a year, you'd probably pay $25,000 more. Or if you buy today, you'd make a profit of $25,000. Now, If you paid the higher mortgage rate for a year and then paid the cost to refinance, maybe that costs you $4,000 or $3,000. So you make a $25,000 profit, a $4,000 expense for the higher carrying cost and for the refinance cost. Well, that's a pretty good trade in my opinion. So I think this is an opportunity right now. Based upon just the basics of supply and demand and the likelihood that lower rates will bring in a lot more buyers to even tilt the supply of, to tilt the amount of demand even greater.
Do you see an influx of real estate investors coming back into the market just based on, you know, this data?
You know, it's interesting because the amount of real estate investors have been relatively stable. It's about one out of every six or seven transactions is a real estate investor. And at one point in time, it got as high as one in every five. But we are seeing that relatively stable. Right now, it's about one out of every seven. About 14%, 15% are real estate investors. And that has been somewhat in the range of where we've seen is what you'd call as close to a word like normal.
Do we have a normal now, Barry?
I don't know. But I do believe that's been relatively stable. Let's put it that way.
I got it. So I heard a stat a long time ago, or not a long time ago, but a while ago, where it was talking about how people who bought in 2020 when the rates were super low were actually regretting their decision because they had to put so much money down and they were up against all of these other buyers. Do you foresee like another type of environment like that where we're now paying $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 over asking if the rates come down? Are we headed into something like that?
I'm not so sure that we'd have that type of a frenzy because lower rates brought people in. But by the way, to your point, those people that purchased 4 years ago, had they even had spent a significant amount over asking price, I think by now they probably have done very well because value is up so much. So while they may have regretted it initially and had a little bit of buyer's remorse, I think that by now they're starting to look back and say, wow, I did pretty darn good. So they were proven to be good decisions.
Yes.
Today, boy, we'd have to see rates drop rather significantly to get that type of an imbalance. Plus, remember that new construction was shut down for like 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. And that shutdown exacerbated the low supply problem. So I don't see that type of, you know, you never want to say never, right? Because we never saw what happened in 2020 happen, you know? So things can happen, but I wouldn't put it as a high probability that you'd see that type of imbalance. But still, there is an imbalance. There is more inventory. You know, a lot of people say, oh, there's been a buildup in inventory, but let's remember the buildup in inventory. Let's take it in perspective. As a nation, we're still well below, approximately 29% is the number below inventory at the same period of time pre-COVID. So the last data we got is July of 2024. So we look at July of 2019. As a measuring point, because you want to look at the same time of year, right? Because there are seasonal fluctuations. Inventory always goes up during the summer. And the reason for that is because of schools. If you are a parent, you want your kid to start at the beginning of the school year. So depending on where you're, they're going to start August, September. So you think about that. I got to put my home on the market, right? Like probably, May, June, July to get it sold so I can move into my house and be there August, September for the school year, right?
Right.
So you always see these peaks and then there's a trough later on. So it's a normal wave. When we are looking at inventory levels from 2019 as a nation, we are 29% below today, below where we were pre-COVID, yet our population has risen. So less inventory, more people in the last 5 years. Okay, that's one thing. And when we also hear people talking about inventory buildup, it is true. It has built up, but from very low levels. Even if you look at July 2023, yes, inventory is higher. But July 2023, goodness gracious, it was really, really, really low. So while it's up, it's still down from normalized levels. Other thing is, where is the inventory? It's not spread out equally. It is spread out predominantly, believe it or not, in two states, Florida, where I am right now, and Texas. Now, that represents, believe it or not, about 40% of all the inventory that's come on the market. Okay, so does that mean those states are in trouble? Well, again, you have to look at it prospectively. Those two states, Texas has seen a 6.5% increase in inventory, but population has increased by 6.6%. So it's not that much out of whack. Florida has seen 4.7% increase, but we've seen 6.2% in population. So maybe it's not even enough inventory, right? And of course, you know, we're doing it state by state. Real estate's really local, as you know, Adam.
Yeah.
So I don't think that there is an inventory scare. But I think there is still an imbalance where there is less inventory than normal. And as we get into the environment with lower rates, we will see inventory get tighter. One other thing to think about. If you take your 25 to 35 year olds in the United States, currently 17% of them are living at home with mom and dad. To put that in perspective for you, we have never seen numbers that high in the last 84 years. The last time it happened was 1940. And that was after the Great Depression, as we all know. There was a housing boom after that because as things normalized, those people said, I don't want to be living with mom and dad forever. It's not a good look. So they wound up moving out on their own. Now, that was because they couldn't get a job. And as they got jobs, they moved out. Today, it's because we've seen an increase in interest rates and affordability has become more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. As rates come down, this enormously high percentage will now start to become buyers. And that demand will push prices higher, just like it has done historically. By the way, in 2010, it was the second highest level. And that was at 15%. So it wasn't quite as high as it is today. Now, that was because we had the great financial crisis.
Yeah.
But as things normalized after that, what did we see? An incredible decade of housing growth that ensued partly because you had all this extra demand that came to the market from these people living at home. So please watch that. It's very few people look at these demographics as closely as we do. But you know, there's a saying that says demographics is destiny. And I believe the destiny is that these people are not going to live with mom and dad forever. It's an overwhelming amount of buying power when rates come down. And I think it's a good idea to mind that as a reason to think that maybe it might be a good idea to be a purchaser.
Gosh, I could sit here and talk to you for 8 hours, Barry. I've got two more questions and I promise I'll let you go. But talking about the 17%, first of all, that's just a ton of people. I couldn't imagine living at home at 35, but good for those people. I'm a loan officer. I'm a real estate agent listening to this podcast, and I know that that number is huge. What advice do I give those people that I know they have the buying power? They just don't trust the economy, or they don't trust the housing market, or they want to sit and wait for rates to come down. How do I have that conversation? What advice do I give them?
Well, we discussed why waiting for rates to come down may not be a good strategy. As far as trusting the economy, I'd have reasons to be concerned about the economy, so I don't fault them. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can make the same rationale for why should I walk out of my house because bad things could happen, right? So, you know, things are going to happen. It should be noted that homeowners have a net worth that is 40 times greater than a renter, 40, okay, 40. And when you look at net worth in the United States, 2/3 of all net worth has come from home equity. Think about those two statistics. Mm-hmm. And what it does tell you is that over time, home ownership has proven to be one of the most important wealth creation tools. So while there is no guarantees in life in anything, and while there are things that can and will go wrong, if you look at things over time, it does appear that it is a very wise decision to be a homeowner as opposed to a renter for so many different reasons. You know, we can include tax deductibility. We can include that you fix your payment. We can include the equity that you build up from the part of your mortgage that is a principal, which is a forced savings plan. And of course, the big one is appreciation. So there's so many reasons why people get rich in real estate, why people create wealth in real estate. It starts with the ownership of your own home. Now, a lot of the same things over time are true for the stock market as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is why you have a wealth gap. The wealth gap is, you know, predominantly created because, you know, people who don't have real estate and who don't have stocks over time, historically, have fallen behind. So I encourage people to look at those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Barry. I can't let you leave without asking our signature question. And that is, how are you going to lend it forward for the rest of the year?
I'm going to lend it forward. Well, I try and do that every day. I really do. I try to help to share knowledge, but specifically right now, what I've gone through with my cancer is, it's very, very scary. And when I first was about to start chemo, there was so little out there to help me to understand what I was about to experience or to give me tips. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do is to lend it forward. And what I decided to do was every day chronicle my journey to tell people what they can expect every single day with just 1 or 2 minute a day of videos, so that this way they could see the progression of, when you lose your hair, how do you feel about that? What could you do? When you get a shot of Udenyca the Monday after chemo, so that your bone marrow creates white blood cells, it is very painful a few days later. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that pain? What could you do? Things about mindset, stomach issues, ways that you can manage that, little tips. And then the big part that I'm really harping on is being educated. I see so many people in these cancer centers where they go for treatment, they can't even name the drugs. They don't even know what's going on. Nobody is better about this than you. One of the things that I get is CIPN, chemo-induced peripheral neuropathy in your fingers and toes. But what I was able to do is take part of my tumor, send it out and test the different medicines. And then understanding one of the medications, one of the chemos, vincristine, had very little sensitivity in helping my tumor, yet it was a culprit in creating neuropathy. So after the fourth round of treatment, I said, I'm experiencing some neuropathy. Here's the test. It's not sensitive. Let's stop the vincristine portion. So of the 6 cancer drugs I was getting, that one was eliminated. And while I still have some neuropathy, I stopped it. Some people suffer with this. So things like this, mm-hmm. It's the education, what to do, making a list of how you would present this to get other opinions, keeping all your scans in one, but all of the things that people should be doing, I'm creating this library and making it available. Tony Robbins is a dear friend. He's also going to make it available. I've spoken to some cancer help groups and making it available for them as just part of their library to help other people. So that's something right now that I'm really working on to lend it forward.
That is amazing, Barry. You're a true inspiration. And we are so grateful to be able to call you a friend. Thank you again for coming on the podcast. We will, I'm sure, have you on again soon.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube and LinkedIn. Tune in next week for another new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSConsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.